life in his name. Now, that kind of sounds like a conclusion to me, right? When the author says, okay, here's where I wrote the book. I wrote it so you may believe, and that by believing you may have life in his name. Credits roll. Don't stand up. Don't throw away your popcorn. Don't put on your coat. There's more. Chapter 21. Afterward, Jesus appeared again to his disciples by the Sea of Tiberias. That's the Sea of Galilee up in the north, the one Jesus walked across in chapter 6. It happened this way. Simon Peter, Thomas, called Didymus, remember him from last week? The twin. Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, remember him from chapter 1? The sons of Zebedee, who are them? James and John, right? And two other disciples, probably Andrew and Philip, were together. How many is that? Any math whizzes? Anybody count that? Somebody answer that? I didn't ask for a lifeline for that question, but I might need it. How many? How many men are out there? Seven. That's right, seven. They're headed back home after the Passover and the Feast of Unleavened Bread. They've gone back to the north where they hail from. They have seen the risen Lord and been sent on a gospel mission. And what are they doing? They're fishing. Look at verse 3. I'm going out to fish, Simon Peter told them. And they said, we'll go with you. So they went out and got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Now, there's nothing wrong with going fishing itself. Right, George? Right? Maybe they were hungry or bored or restless while they were waiting for more details of their marching orders. We don't know. Perhaps they needed to make some money. This was their livelihood for at least four of these guys. So perhaps they needed to go fishing. They fish at night, because that's when the fish are often biting, and so that they can sell the freshest fish in the morning, right? If these are caught, they were caught overnight, and now they're on your table. But it's called fishing, not catching, right, Peter? That's for a reason. These experienced fishermen go all night without a bite, or in their fishing, with nets. Their nets are empty that night. And then the morning came, and so did Jesus. Verse 4. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize that it was Jesus, just like Mary in the garden, right? He called out to them, friends, haven't you any fish? No, they answered. That's always the question for fishermen, isn't it? No, they have no fish to sell. That's what they assume. Nothing to show for a whole night's work except bleary eyes. Verse 6. He said, throw your net on the right side of the boat and you will find some. When they did, they were unable to haul the net in because of the large number of fish. Wow, that's a miracle, right? That's a miracle. All of a sudden they're straining at the nets because they can't pull the whole thing up into the boat. And John knew what that meant. And I love the way Keegan read this. Verse 7. Then the disciple whom Jesus loved, I think that's John, said to Peter, it is the Lord. As soon as Simon Peter heard him say, it is the Lord, he wrapped his outer garment around him, for he'd taken it off, and jumped into the water. That's so Peter, isn't it? I don't think Peter's thinking straight, right? Like, if you're in the boat and you're going to get in the water, do you put on more clothes or less clothes? Right? He puts on more clothes to jump in the water. Maybe it's because he stripped down for work and he wanted to be presentable to his Lord. Any way about it, he is gung-ho. He does the cannonball into the lake, and he swims the length of a football field to get to shore. Verse 8. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish. For they were not far from shore, about 100 yards. When they landed, they saw a fire of burning coals there with fish on it and some bread. Jesus had his own fish. He was successful that night as a fisherman. And he's made breakfast. The strangest breakfast meeting there ever was. Verse 10. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish you have just caught." Wink, wink. Wonder how all that fish got there. Simon Peter climbed aboard and dragged the net ashore with the other guys. It was full of large fish, 153. But even with so many, the net was not torn. That's another miracle, right? Jesus said to them, "Come and have breakfast." None of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew it was the Lord. I grabbed the title for this message from verse 7. What John said in the boat that caused Peter to jump out of the boat. It is the Lord. It's him. I know it's him. I can tell. It's obvious from these miracles, from what he asks, from his voice, from his heart. It is the Lord. Point number one of three. It is the Lord actually alive again. Jesus is alive. He's not still dead, and he is still alive. That resurrection thing was not a temporary deal. This is later, and he's still alive. And friends, he's still alive today. Amen? And it's obvious that it's him. At first, they don't recognize him. But by verse 12, they all knew. They all knew it was the Lord. None of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" They knew. They knew that they were having breakfast with Jesus. The real Jesus. The actual, factual Jesus who had been dead but is now alive. It is the Lord. And he's not just meeting them at breakfast time, he's making them breakfast. When I preached this passage before on May 7th in the year 2000, I put across the top of the sermon handout, "Dead men don't make breakfast." Jesus is actually, factually, miraculously alive again, and it makes all the difference. Can you imagine what this breakfast was like? Ever had fish for breakfast? Sometimes, I guess. The smell of fish grilling over the burning coals. Wet old Peter with his hair and beard matted down and glistening with water. And everybody's staring at Jesus. At least that's what I would be doing. I'd be watching his every move. Not that long ago, he was dead. His heart had stopped. His lungs had stopped. His brain had stopped. He was gone. And now he's back. And he's serving everybody their food. Look at verse 13. Jesus came, took the bread and gave it to them, and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. Third time when a bunch of them were all together. After, he says, he was raised from the dead. Just in case you missed it, he was raised from the dead. See, that really happened. This isn't a fable or a myth or just a story. This isn't fiction. This is history. I think that's the point of the 153 fish in verse 11. Christians have had all kinds of theories about what is intended by the number 153 in verse 11. Perhaps you've heard them. There's all kinds of theories out there. Some are better than others. Some are more plausible than others. But here's what I think the point of the number 153 is in verse 11. You ready? I think it means that there were 153 fish. Literally. That's how many there were. Fishermen count this sort of thing because this is how they make their money. Right? If you're in business, you want to know how many you have to sell. Right? And it was a lot. It was a miracle. And if it symbolizes anything, it just symbolizes blessing. The blessing that comes when you obey Jesus. If simply just obediently throwing your net over on the other side of the boat will yield 153 fish, imagine what will happen if you obediently try to go fishing for men. Apart from me, you can do nothing, Jesus said. But with him, all things are possible. One time I had a quiz in seminary, and I was asked how many fish there were in John 21:11. And the answer was 153. Got it right. Why have a quiz on that? Well, John thought it was important enough to include that detail. So here it is. The Holy Spirit thought it was important enough to include that little detail. So here it is. But the reason it's important is because that's how many fish there actually were. And that means that Jesus is actually alive again. To me, it has the mark of an eyewitness to it. If John gets the little details right, it makes all the more plausible that he got the big detail right. It is the Lord. Actually, factually, miraculously alive again. And handing out breakfast to all his followers. A little delicious foretaste of the kingdom to come. But there was more to this strange breakfast meeting. Jesus has an agenda for this meeting. Specifically for his follower, Simon Peter. They have some unfinished business. Look at verse 15. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you truly love me more than these? Here's our second point this morning. It is the Lord asking if we truly love him. Now, obviously, he was asking Peter here, but I don't think it's too big of a jump to get to us today. Do you truly love me? Jesus asks. Jesus said to Peter, do you truly love me more than these? And of course, the interpretive question is, these what? Right? These fish? Do you love me more than 153 fish, Peter? Or these fishing implements, nets, boats, the whole fishing business. Do you love me more than your old life, Peter? Or it could be these other disciples. Peter, do you love me more than Thomas and Nathaniel and James and John and these other two guys? Could be any of those. Could be something else. I tend to think it's more than these other disciples do. Peter, you said you loved me more than anything. Not long ago, you said you would lay down your life for me, Mr. Rock. You love me more than these other guys who are going to run away. But when the time came, you denied that you even knew me. And you did it three times. One, two, three, rooster crow. And you did it next to a fire of burning coals in a courtyard. Kind of like that one right over there with the fish on it. Do you remember that, Peter? Peter does remember that. And he's ashamed. But he also knows that he does love Jesus. And that Jesus knows it. Verse 15 again. Yes, Lord, he said. You know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my lambs. He doesn't say, feed my fish, though he could have. Jesus reaches back towards John chapter 10 when he said that he was the good shepherd and that his people are his sheep, that's us. And Jesus says that if Peter actually factually loves Jesus, then he will feed Jesus' lambs. Peter will take care of God's people. He'll be an under-shepherd, a subordinate shepherd to the chief shepherd. But Jesus doesn't stop there. He asks again. Verse 16. Again, Jesus said, Simon, son of John, Do you truly love me? He answered, Yes, Lord. You know that I love you. Jesus said, Take care of my sheep. By the way, there's a few different words here for love and for sheep in the Greek, but I don't think he's making a big point with that. It's just stylistic to use varied vocabulary when you want to get a major point across. And the major point is the major question. Do you truly love me? He's not just asking if Peter has affection for him. He's asking if Peter cares more about Jesus than anything else. He's asking if he is Peter's number one priority. Do you truly love me more than these? And he's asking him three times. Probably because Peter denied him three times. And he's giving Peter the chance to undo all of that and renounce it. Verse 17. The third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my sheep. That was hard for Peter. But it was good for Peter. He had to own his own failures, and he did. And then he got Jesus' forgiveness. That's it. From this point on, Peter is fully restored. From this point on, Peter has a leading role once again. Read the rest of the book. Read the book of Acts. Read 1 Peter, 2 Peter. Peter says, Lord, you know all things. Which is very true. He knows all the bad. And he knows all the good. He knows that Peter does love him. So Jesus says, feed my sheep. Now, those words are very important to me because of my calling to be a people shepherd myself. Just like Peter, I'm supposed to take the word of God and feed it piece by piece, like I'm doing now, to the flock entrusted to my care. And I do it just like Peter because I love Jesus. Now, I love you guys too. But I love you because I love him. And he knows it. He knows all things. And he knows that I love him. And he's called me to feed his sheep. But this truth is not just for pastors. It's for all who love Jesus. You can tell if you love Jesus by whether or not you love his people. Do you feel the logic there? Do you love me? Do you truly love me? Then love my lambs. Make sure they're cared for. It's not enough to say that we love Jesus. We need to love Jesus by loving his people. What did he say? Right before he predicted Peter's denial in chapter 13, Jesus said, A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you must love. That's been our theme for all of 2024. By this, all men will know you are my disciples if you say that you love me? No. If you have a fish symbol on your car? Because John 21? How about if you have 153 fish symbols on the back of your car? No. If you post Christian memes all day long on social media, then the world will know that you love me. No. By this all men will know you are my disciples if you love one another. How are we doing at that? How are we doing at loving other Christians? And not just the ones that are like us or who are easy to love, but the ones who are different from us and difficult to love. You know who I mean. Their faces come up in your mind when I ask the question, how are we doing at loving other Christians? Because one key way to know that we actually factually love the Good Shepherd is that we actually factually love his sheep. Feed my sheep. And that's what Peter does. For the rest of his life, with all of his ups and his downs, never perfectly, he's dedicated to shepherding the flock of God. Read 1 Peter. You see it all over it. And then he will die for Jesus. Talk about a strange breakfast meeting. At this breakfast, Jesus tells Peter how he's going to die. Look at verse 18. I tell you the truth, when you were younger, you dressed yourself and went where you wanted, but when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. Jesus said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Then he said to him, "Follow me." On one level, that must have been encouraging. I mean it. Jesus, who is back from the dead, just told Peter he's going to live to be an old man. But he's also told him he's going to lose his freedom and his life. You will stretch out your hands and someone else will dress you and lead you where you do not want to go. The kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. Historical tradition indicates that the Apostle Peter was crucified upside down. According to the tradition, Peter refused to be crucified right side up because he didn't feel worthy of dying like his Lord did. That's unverified, but it speaks volumes, doesn't it? Jesus knew that Peter did love him and would die as a martyr for Jesus. And now Peter knows that Peter will die as a martyr for Jesus. What that must have been like to go through life knowing what was coming. How's that for a post-credits preview of what's to come? Verse 19, then he said to him, "Follow me." Point number three, and last, it is the Lord calling us to follow him, even to our deaths. Are you ready to do that? Are you willing to do that? Do you believe that Jesus is worth that? I do. I believe that because Jesus is alive today, he is worth dying for today. And he's worth following with my life, which is sometimes like 1,000 little deaths every day. Dying to self and selfishness and living for Jesus and his kingdom. We're not all called to be martyrs, but we are all called to follow him. And that's the point of this next and last section. Jesus is calling us to follow him in our own particular paths. Look at verse 20. Apparently Jesus and Peter have gone for a little walk after breakfast, walking off breakfast. And John and probably the others are following close behind them. Verse 20. Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved, John just can't get over how much he was loved, was following them. This was the one who had leaned back against Jesus at the supper and had said, "Lord, who's going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he asked, "Lord, what about him? You've told me how I'm going to die. What about John? You know, the fast one? He beat me in that foot race to the tomb the other day. Is he going to beat me to his own grave? Lord, what about him?" That's a dangerous question, isn't it? When we start comparing ourselves and God's plan for us with someone else and God's plan for them. Jesus, why does that Christian go through cancer and I'm healthy? Jesus, why do I lose my job because I was a witness for you and that guy is allowed to share about you on his coffee break? Jesus, why does that disciple have a strong, healthy family and I'm supposed to navigate this dysfunctional one? Jesus, why does that believer always seem to be losing money and I'm amply supplied for? Lord, what about him? How does Jesus answer that? He says back, in effect, none of your beeswax. Verse 22, Jesus answered, "If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me." See, it's none of your business. What is that to you? You must follow me on the path I have marked out for you. I've got a path for him, and I've got a path for you. Don't worry about his path. Worry about staying on yours. Don't fall into the comparison trap. You must follow me. And don't miss that he says, until I return. Did you catch that? Or until I come. There's another post-credits preview of coming attractions. Jesus is going away one more time, but he's coming back. And until then, we follow him with our lives, and if needs be, our deaths. You must follow me. Now in verse 23, John clears up a misconception that some people formed when they heard about what Jesus said in verse 22. Because of this, the rumor spread among the brothers that this disciple would not die. But Jesus did not say that he would not die. He only said, if I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? I'm not going to tell you what's going to happen to John right now. That's between me and John. This is the disciple who testifies to these things and who wrote them down. We know that his testimony is true. Which I think is a funny thing for the author to say, but there it is. We know it is true because it is me who wrote it. But he's saying, I lived it. I saw it. I was there. And I wrote what I lived. And I want you to believe it, because if you believe in Jesus, you will have life in his name. He's actually, factually, miraculously alive again. And he's asking us to love him. And he's calling us to follow him. And he is so worth it. I can't tell you how worthy he is. John says, I couldn't fit it all in the book. I didn't even try. I didn't even give you the half of it. Here's how John ends his book, verse 25. Jesus did many other things as well. If every one of them were written down, I suppose that even the whole world would not have room for the books that would be written. Jesus is infinitely greater than what I've told you in these pages. He's everything I've told you. He's the bread of life. He's the light of the world. He's the gate for the sheep. He's the good shepherd. He's the resurrection and the life. He is the way and the truth and the life. He is the vine, and we are the branches. He is the Word, and he was with God, and he is God. And he has become flesh and made his dwelling among us that first Christmas. And we have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only, the Monogenes, who came from the Father, full of grace and truth. And he has died for our sins. It is finished. And he's come back to life. He's been raised from the dead. He has overcome the world. This is not the end of the story. It's the new beginning of the rest of the story that will never end. It is the Lord. Oh, come, let us adore him.